In The Ascent of Money, author Neil Ferguson says that finance is the foundation of human progress, and that financial history is the essential backstory behind all history. In it, he explains how banks provided the material basis for the Italian Renaissance, how the bond market was a decisive factor in conflicts from the Seven Years' War to the American Civil War. He points out the origins of the French Revolution in a stock market bubble and shows how a financial revolution is propelling the world's most populous country from poverty to power in a single generation. But the single most important lesson, he says, of financial history is that sooner or later, every bubble bursts. Sooner or later, the bearish sellers outnumber the bullish buyers, and sooner or later, greed flips into fear. We'll discuss how history can be helpful at a moment like this, and what can it tell us about our current crisis and the possible ways out. Neil Ferguson is Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard University, a senior research fellow at Jesus College, Oxford, a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, an op-ed columnist for the LA Times, and the author of several books. The newest is The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. He was my guest in October 2006 to talk about his previous book, The War of the World. Welcome again, Neil Ferguson.
Pleasure to be with you, Terry.
Neil, first, a couple of questions about your life and your work. I like people to get a feel for the people behind the ideas we talk about. And you have said that you had a mixed experience as a student at Oxford. In fact, you said, I spent 2 years doing everything but work. What did you do for those 2 years, and what caused you to change your course?
Oh, Terry, how long have you got? I played the double bass. I acted rather badly in a number of plays. I tried my hand at student journalism. I think I wrote a particularly dreadful film script. I drank quite a lot of Guinness. I probably made more passes than was advisable at women. I did what, you know, you're really not supposed to do at college, and I did it pretty intensively for 2 years. And then I had a moment of truth when I suddenly realized I was quite bad at all these things. In fact, I was quite spectacularly dreadful at them, particularly the girls. And I decided to get back to my core competence, which was in fact studying history. And so I spent the final year cramming 3 years' work into 1 year and trying to turn myself into a historian, which I just about managed.
And what you point out that's interesting is that at Oxford, I don't know whether it's at all the, you know, British universities or whatever, but there you can do what you did. You can screw up and redeem yourself with this final semester, something which wouldn't work nearly as well at U.S. colleges. Is that the case?
That's absolutely right. It would be disastrous here at Harvard, and I would be very, very stern with any of my students here who behave the way I did, which is known as hypocrisy. But, of course, under the American system, you get your grades as you go along, continuous assessment. In Oxford, that's changed to some degree, but in Oxford you could show up and really encounter no significant assessment of your performance until the very last semester of your final year. And that was, to me, a tremendously attractive system because I guess at age 17, 18, I felt there were other things to be explored about life than book learning, which I had done fairly intensively at high school. And Oxford did give me the chance to discover that I was bad at everything else except academics, and I'm grateful to Oxford for that chance. Here at Harvard, they can't really take these chances if they're serious about their studies. There's a sort of fairly unrelenting pressure to deliver those A's semester after semester, but that's probably a good thing. I'm sure, with the benefit of hindsight, I could have learned a great deal more than I did at Oxford, and I've spent the rest of my life frantically trying to catch up.
Right. Now, one of the things, though, that I'm going to point out that it seems to me is a bit of a connection between your wasted years and your current years is you write prolifically. You teach at Harvard, Harvard Business School, research fellow at Oxford, and so on. But you're also quite a public or media figure. Several of your books have made it into BBC miniseries. Your new book, the one we're talking about today, The Ascent of Money, was recently on PBS. You even made a recent appearance on the Colbert Report. in which I thought you actually, a friend of mine recommended that. They said, you know, hey, this guy that was on Colbert last night, he did really well.
Well, thank you.
Some of your peers look down on such activities, but it seems to me your early acting and so on may come into play. How do you feel these two sides of your work fit together?
It's always seemed to me that history is too important to be confined to universities and to the so-called intellectuals. And my aim for years has been to try to communicate the research I do to the widest possible audience, because it seems to me that a society needs to understand its past if it's to be a stable and successful society. You can write books and try to get people to buy them, but in the end there's no substitute for television, for radio. And so I've done those things. I've written many newspaper articles over the years as well, in the somewhat naive belief, but the sincere belief, that the more people who hear these ideas, the better. And I think this is well illustrated in the case of the Ascent of Money. Financial history is not mainstream history. Most people know very, very little about it. Most people indeed assume that history is about presidents, battles, generals, not bankers and the bond market. But I think the times we're living through now show very, very clearly that financial history is often the driver of political history. And if we don't understand how it works, if we simply assume it's a black box that somebody else should figure out, we're very likely to be on the wrong side of the financial markets when they take one of their periodic nosedives.
Right. How did the writing of this book, The Ascent of Money, Financial History of the World, coincide? Obviously, the timing of the publication, the timing of the PBS series are pretty good for getting noticed, given what's going on. But how did the writing coincide with the evolution of the current international financial crisis?
Well, that's a good question. About 2.5 years ago, I became convinced that a book on financial history should be written that would reach a wide audience, that would not be full of jargon and equations, that would be completely accessible to the layman, because I was confident that a crisis was coming. It seemed to me in 2006 that the markets were drunk, as it were, on their own liquidity. People had started to believe crazy things, like there would never be another recession, that the problem of risk had been solved, that volatility was dead. I mean, I heard these things at conferences, and it dawned on me that there was a kind of delusional quality to the mood in the markets, particularly among the bankers and the hedge fund managers. And that's a sure sign that something really bad is just coming. So I started to talk about the dangers of a liquidity crisis if credit markets seized up and highly leveraged institutions couldn't roll their debt over. I started writing about what would happen if the United States became excessively indebted and dependent on foreign capital. And the reception I generally got in 2006 was, to put it mildly, skeptical.
By the way, let me just say, we started talking about some of those things, I know, on this show in, I believe, 2004, tipped by some bloggers that the bill was going to come due in 2007 and 2008. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that conversation was going on in my book, Colossus, The Rise and Fall of the American Empire, published in 2004. But as I said, you know, for another 3 years, people in the markets were in denial. So I wrote the book and made the television series anticipating some kind of major shock. And then the shock struck more or less as I was finishing the book. And that, I can tell you, was quite a hair-raising experience in its own right. You know, writing history is difficult when the history keeps on happening. Just as soon as you put your pen down, more history happens. Even now, I'm you know, bracing myself to revise for the paperback edition later this year. But it's been exciting, and I think for a variety of reasons, I think mainly the benefit of the historical perspective, I got this right and saw this coming and was able to write a book that was pointing in the right direction.
Right. One of the things in the intro that I mentioned was that the single most important lesson of financial history is that sooner or later every bubble bursts, sooner or later greed flips into fear. I have certainly talked about how we've done this now in basically sort of three bubbles in a row, with the high-tech bubble, then the sort of what was, it seemed to me, a little different than that, the broader corporate bubble, and then the real estate bubble. If this keeps happening, if this is the single biggest lesson of history, why? Why? Why do we keep letting it happen? Why do the smart people get caught?
Well, it's psychology. at root. You know, Terry, the idea that man is an economic calculating machine who is able, with the perfect information at his disposal, accurately to price every asset and commodity is a fantasy of the economics textbooks. The reality is that we are the products of evolution, and experimental psychology shows that we're tremendously bad at making probabilistic assessments of the future. We are subject to great mood swings, and when we're doing well, we believe it's not luck, it's our genius, and this can only continue. And when we're disappointed and things go wrong, we tend to overreact and talk as if it's the end of the world and of civilization as we know it. So I think at the heart of the volatility of financial markets is the human condition, is the human mind. And I try to make the point that behavioral finance, which is a whole new discipline in the academy, illuminates financial markets in many ways better than traditional economics. I mean, I think traditional economics has kind of failed in this crisis. It's been exposed as a very limited and unsatisfactory discipline because it attempted to turn the world into something that was essentially a mathematical model.
Right.
Now, these models are very useful, but they don't, in fact, take account of the human factor sufficiently. And that, I think, is why very, very few mainstream economists anticipated this crisis.
Right, right. And in other words, and it seems to me that when you get from the different spheres of society to finance is one of the ones where these mood swings can have the most rapid effect, correct? In other words, you can't retool a factory really quickly. You even can't sell a house really quickly, but you can buy and sell a stock, a bond, a derivative immediately.
That's right. The markets are very liquid and very fast-moving most of the time. But remember, they can completely seize up. And what we saw beginning in August of 2007 and reaching a climax in September, October of last year was a complete paralysis of the credit markets. Suddenly, you simply couldn't borrow money. Banks wouldn't lend to one another. They wouldn't lend to corporations. And that sort of moment of ghastly standstill is what is most scary in a financial system. That was the kind of liquidity crisis that I had been warning about in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. That the other point, though, which makes the amplification effect so devastating, is leverage.
Exactly.
If you are a bank and you decide to take a position and you then multiply the position by a factor of 30 by borrowing 30 times your capital, if you get it wrong, it doesn't need to go badly wrong for your capital to be obliterated. And what we saw over the last decade, and particularly the last 5 years, was a tremendous run-up in the indebtedness of financial institutions, because the only way they could keep on paying double-digit returns or getting really positive returns on their equity was by leveraging increasingly and taking on more debt. That was really the biggest risk at the heart of the system. And I think the regulators on both sides of the Atlantic were asleep at the wheel as this was going on.
Right. One of the things that you talk about is Alan Greenspan, and I must say William Grider was looking over Greenspan's shoulder for much of his time as Federal Reserve Chairman, pointing out some of these things, but that he took seriously and reacted to and acted on wage inflation and consumer price inflation, but he seemed to ignore real estate inflation and securities inflation. Talk more about that.
A doctrine developed in the late 1990s that central banks should only really focus on consumer price inflation, and not only that, on core inflation. They should even ignore housing and energy costs. And if they focused on that, and in some cases explicitly targeted it, then the world would be a better place. The problem of inflation would be solved. Indeed, the problem of economic volatility and the business cycle would be solved. In 2004, Ben Bernanke said the great moderation had arrived, that recessions would get smaller and less frequent thanks to the cleverness of central bankers. The problem was that inflation had just moved. It had moved from the consumer price index, not least because of the downward drift of Asian technology prices. It had moved into the asset markets. And even as the central bankers were celebrating the low volatility and the low rate of inflation, asset prices, first in the stock market and then the housing market, were going nuts. So how could inflation really be dead if you had house prices rising at 20% a year, which they were at the peak in 2006-7? That was, I think, a fundamental mistake in the theory of monetary policy. It wasn't just Alan Greenspan, though he certainly believed it. A great many economists took the same view.
Well,
it became the consensus.
Yeah, and so I'm asking sort of how. I mean, these guys, if they're stuck away at some college, I sort of understand it, but Greenspan and his colleagues are right in the thick of it. This is, you know, how could they? And even if they were looking at their own accounts or their neighbors' accounts, they could see this happening. How could this have happened? When you look back at it, what clouded their vision so badly? Did it serve them?
Well, I think there are two answers to that question. One is that it seemed to work. They said to themselves, we've been clever. Every time there's been a bubble, we've intervened when it burst, and we've avoided a hard landing, unlike the Japanese. So there was a lot of complacency about how the United States had coped with the 97-98 Asian crisis, how it coped with 2000-2001 recession, and the sense that somehow all you needed to do was stand ready when the markets fell to prop them up, and you could avoid a painful recession. But all that did was to postpone the reckoning and in some ways make the reckoning more dramatic because of the problem of moral hazard. If you were in the stock market in the 1990s, there was the Greenspan put, which meant that you didn't really need to worry about a stock market sell-off because Greenspan guaranteed to put the market back as soon as possible to its previous peak. That was an extremely dangerous signal to send to the markets because it made the stock market look like a one-way bet. Same in real estate. People started to believe, and they really did believe this, that real estate prices could only go up. Now, there's ample evidence historically that that's not true. Even in the early 1990s, Britain saw real prices of housing fall by 30%. Japan had a massive property crash after the 1989 bubble burst. But people here were in denial. They thought it didn't apply to the United States. I think the other reason that people came to believe this somewhat crazy doctrine that the asset price inflation didn't matter was just groupthink. The economists who advised the Fed, and one of them confessed this in a recent newspaper article, collectively believed that they were much cleverer than they really were. And when it would show up at these meetings, nobody wanted to step out of line and say, you know, the emperor has no clothes. We are, in fact, deluding ourselves. And so groupthink took over. The economists formed a single conventional view, and I'm afraid the rest is financial history.
Yeah, and one of the things I always notice is when you hear on it's radio or television or you know, in the financial press, people talking about the real estate sector, it will almost always be people whose interest is served by the psychology staying positive. I would assume the same is true of anyone who's not a truly outside observer of securities and stocks and bonds as well.
The financial press has been manipulated by speculators since time immemorial. In the 19th century, it was standard in the days of the Rothschilds to use the press to talk up the stock if you were making a major IPO, a major issue of new securities. And I haven't been at all surprised to see the press playing a particularly dubious role in this crisis. There have certainly been some abuse of media channels to drive down prices of shares that were being sold short. On the other hand, the momentum was already there. I think all the media did was to communicate the fear of what was happening in the financial sector.
Okay, let me ask one more question about this historic, and then I want to talk a little bit about what solutions being talked about now look like to you. We talked already about these bright guys in finance, I'm reminded of the documentary by Oscar winner Alex Gibney about Enron called The Smartest Guys in the Room,
yes,
based on a book about that. And then you quote Harvard grad numbers. You say that in 1970, about 5% of men graduating from Harvard went into finance. 5%. By 1990, 15%. Class of 2007, 20% of the men and 10% of the women expected their first job to be at banks. I mean, that's 20% of every man graduating from Harvard. Why do you think this is? And Kevin Phillips talks about this huge shift from actually making things to finance. Why do you think this was happening, besides the fact that it was how you make a fast buck? And what does it mean for a society?
Well, it certainly was driven by the far higher rewards available in finance than in other professions, and indeed rewards that got to you pretty early on in your career. It was no wonder that people followed the money. Did it matter? Well, it obviously mattered in the sense that this was excessive. There's no question that the financial sector in the United States, in Britain, to say nothing of smaller economies like Iceland, grew out of all proportion, and I think began to suck talent out of other sectors of the economy in quite a deleterious way. I mean, a good example of this is the fact that that the quantitative finance attracted the talents of a great many people with PhDs in engineering, because in fact the mathematics of quantitative finance bear some resemblance to the mathematics you learn when you're a highly competent engineer. That meant that there were fewer engineers to go around. They were all too busy designing collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps. It's probably no bad thing that trend is going to reverse, and the class of 2009 is not going to be a 20% right. 20% recruited into Wall Street. I think it's going to be closer to 5%, if that.
Right.
I mean, in the end, of course, you know, it's naive to imagine that the United States could have stayed a predominantly manufacturing economy any more than it could have stayed an agricultural economy in the 19th century. There is a fundamental shift away from manufacturing towards services. Not least because you can add value added more readily in services. It also has the advantage that you're not polluting the atmosphere. As anybody who visits China will tell you, manufacturing has its downside.
Mm-hmm.
When the global economy is functioning in a stable way, there's no reason why there shouldn't be comparative advantage, and there's no reason why manufacturing shouldn't primarily go on in Asia, while the English-speaking world provides the financial services. But it's a highly unstable system, as we are now discovering. You've got a highly integrated world economy in which resources are optimally allocated, but it's like a power grid. When there's a surge, the thing can crash, and that's what we're witnessing now.
Right. Let me go with that. I we may not even get into the solutions. I'm really sorry. But another thought that occurred to me, in a famous cover story in Wired magazine, Bill Joy of Sun Microsystems, perhaps the greatest programmer of them all, warned of computers' capacity to get out of control and harm us. He was thinking of nanotechnology, self-replicating viruses, that sort of thing. But isn't, to some extent, this financial economic crisis the first case of a computer-generated global catastrophe? And by that I mean the role of the super sophisticated computer modeling that fed on itself with feedback loops and greater leverage and greater debt, so that values became virtual and virtually determined and more difficult to be regulated. Your thoughts?
There's no question that computers have played a really important part in this story. From 1987, it became clear that automated trading decisions could amplify a crisis. And I think that's been even more true in the last 2 years. The extent to which finance became, as it were, a branch of mathematics in the past decade really can't be overstated. And I tell the story in The Ascent of Money of long-term capital management, a highly sophisticated hedge fund, which blew up in 1998 because, although the mathematics was very ingenious, they had left history out of account. Fascinatingly, the business model that they had didn't die out. It was, in fact, then replicated, not just by hundreds, but by thousands of different hedge funds, all adopting the same mathematical models, all assuming that if they had a diversified enough portfolio, they could put on 30 times leverage and make a ton of money. And indeed, they did for about 5 years, and then they, too, fell victim to the unforeseen crisis. And I think this is the key. It's the models that are to blame. Somebody asked me, you know, who's to blame for this crisis? And I said, you know, we shouldn't just be blaming human beings, individuals like Alan Greenspan, or for that matter, the people who ran the investment banks. We should also blame the models, because creating mathematical models and basing a decision making on, say, value at risk, which is a highly complex notion of risk management, was a recipe for disaster, because these models do not incorporate the kind of thing that I'm talking about in The Ascent of Money, and that is the human element, the psychological element, and also the historical dimension. I mean, anybody who knows any financial history, even going back 50 years, much less 100 or 200 years, knows that very big crises do happen, and they tend to happen once or twice a century, and every decade sees at least one financial crisis. Well, the mathematical models said that that stuff hardly ever happened, and that largely was because they were using data going back no further than 5 years. Value at risk models typically take 5 years of data, and they infer the biggest likely loss that you could suffer in 99% of trading days. People swore by these until last year. They thought this essentially solved the problem of risk management.
Right.
These models were completely wrong. They were actually dangerous in themselves, and they should be scrapped and never used again.
Right. And the thing that I was saying was that we don't have time to go into it. We're gonna wrap up now, Neil Ferguson. But that what they were selling, what they were trading, when you get into the credit default swaps, and the more sophisticated and arcane derivatives, were computer created ephemera, right? That made it difficult, and it's why we're in one of the problems we're in right now, which is how do you value these things that kind of are so divorced from any tangible reality?
A huge superstructure of derivatives is built on top of a pretty narrow base of real assets, including subprime mortgages.
Okay, I gotta end it there. So the book is The Ascent of Money. The website is neilferguson.com, and that's spelled NIALL Ferguson.com. Thank you, Neil Ferguson. Keep up the good work.